You are now listening to Bookish, The Canon Continues, the podcast that's dismantling the sacred secular divide two books at a time, with your hosts, Michelle Collins and Danielle Kingstrom.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Bookish, The Canon Continues. We're here to pontificate a little bit on some books, to share our opinions, to rouse up a few arguments, and hopefully learn some new stuff. I think that'll be exciting. What about you, Danielle?
Yeah, I agree. I'm down with that. That's what awesome. We're here to do.
Excellent. Well, I think you're up first today.
I am.
I'm excited to hear about your book, because when you introduced it last time, I was like, ooh, that's still along some lines of some books I haven't got to yet. So I'm very excited to listen.
Yeah. Well, today's selection is called The Body Is Not an Apology, The Power of Radical Self-Love, written by Sonia Renee Taylor. And just a little background, she is the founder and radical executive officer of The Body Is Not an Apology, a digital media and education company committed to radical self-love and body empowerment as the foundational tool for social justice and global transformation. This book is, wow. I found out about her while I was listening to a Russell Brand podcast.
I love him.
And yeah, he's great. And yeah, the whole concept of body image and self-love for the body is really important, specifically to me. And this book really triggered a lot of memories for me. It made me go back into, and she asks you to, there are 31 unapologetic inquiries that she has you ask yourself while you're traveling through all these different ideas. And I think it's on purpose to make you kind of dive back into your past. You recall your first moments where you recognized that your body was different, or maybe where you recognized the first time you experienced body shame. There was a statement in particular about this book that really stood out for me that made me go, whoa. And it was this: our responsibility to humanity is to unearth the ways in which we have been sabotaging the blueprints and thwarting the radical self-love efforts of others. And it instantly took me back to my childhood. And having already been introduced to some of her unapologetic inquiries that kind of asked you to dig back anyway, I was already traveling through my first experience of body shame, as well as considering the ways in which I had shamed other girls growing up. So when I was in elementary school, I was picked on constantly for being very skinny. My friends could fit their fingers around my wrists and my ankles, called me chicken legs. And I was rather boyish looking, thanks to my mother's thrifty haircuts. I looked like a very scrawny, sick little boy for most of elementary school. You know, to kind of push back against that, to create a shield for myself, I became angry. And I thought, well, this is what we do. You're showing me how we treat each other. And so when I was called skinny, I would call people fat. It was the opposite. It was, okay, I'll play this game. And for many years, you know, the skinny girls got away with doing that. We picked on the one or two larger girls that were in our class, and nobody said anything. It was just the norm. It was accepted. And I look back and I even thinking about how acceptable it was for all of us to ridicule each other just kind of demonstrates the toxicity of society and how early it starts. But even going beyond that, just the idea of being fat was a fear for me. You know, my parents would watch TV and make comments that maybe they didn't realize was being caught by me and my sisters. And of course, growing up in a culture of, you know, MTV, VH1, models and, you know, what it looks like to be a beautiful woman, I compared myself left and right. I didn't get boobs, I swear, until I was 16. And so I just always felt like I was in this foreign body that was rejected. And I think a lot of women experience that, and we don't realize how early we experience it. And I thought back and I'm like, I was 4 or 5 when I first felt shame for my body because it was too skinny. And I started thinking, well, and then it brought me into how I've treated my daughter. And my daughter is larger than me. Now, after I had her, my sisters had no remorse for shaming me about gaining weight. Aww. And they were younger than me. Yeah. And they were younger than me. So it was always my goal to hurry up and get fit. And I that was what, 99, 2000, 2001. So that was the coming of age when we saw these star celebrities go from pregnant to instant skinny overnight. And I felt like I had to keep up with that. And that was when Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and Destiny's Child and everybody had just come out and everyone was showing their bellies. And I was sitting here like ashamed of my stretch marks. And my sisters especially loved to ridicule me about how my body changed. Oh. And women have, you know, we go through such an incredible transformation when we give birth to a child.
Yeah.
And that alone, to have it coupled with shame, especially from people that, you know, are your sisters or are people that, you know, you think love and care about you. I mean, you know, my Lillian and Julian's father was not exactly positive about how my body had transformed after I had his children either. So it was like, so she asks you, in one of her unapologetic inquiries, is in what ways have you had to apologize for your body?
Yeah.
And for me, it was instant. I always apologized for my stretch marks when I got into a relationship with a man after I had my children. I'm sorry, I have stretch marks. I feel bad about that. And I thought, there are so many times women are apologizing for their body. And, you know, we're not our bodies really. We're our bodies are our containers.
Right.
And what we believe about our bodies, we unfortunately take as our identity. And so we live in this perpetuation of shaming ourselves internally and then apologizing for ourselves.
Right.
And that was just such a strong revelation in the book to really kind of take a look at women in general, to go look at what we do to ourselves, number one.
Yeah.
And look at what we do to our sisters.
Yeah.
So,
whole idea of having kids, I mean, you know, is supposed to be this positive thing. And so having the remembrance of that, so to speak, on your body should be something you're proud of.
Exactly.
You know, but you're right. It is something. It's something I'm very, very conscious of and currently very conscious of because of some stuff that I'm planning to do. I'm very aware of it. And you and I have both had a set of twins. And honestly, that destroys your body. I mean, there's no way around that most of the time. And so I'm having to kind of, even now at 53 years old, I'm having to overcome how that looks and embrace it rather than say, you know, I hate how this looks. And you're right. It's sad. It's sad that we do that to ourselves or to one another.
So have you ever been asked to apologize for your body?
I don't know that anybody specifically has ever said to me, you know, something that I felt like I needed to apologize to them for. I do it almost automatically.
Yeah.
I apologize to my, you know, I make excuses for myself all the time. I know my husband very much will get on to me when I do that and say, stop it. But it's about how we feel about us. And so we're projecting that outwards. We're putting that on other people as though they're the ones that have said it. And in some cases, maybe that's true. I mean, like you had your sisters, but I don't remember ever having anybody say those things to me. And I have a little bit of different experience though. And I don't know if she kind of goes over this in the book or not, but you know, and as I've mentioned before, and I won't go into great detail, but I grew up with sexual abuse.
Yeah.
So that creates a whole different body conscious identity.
Yeah.
You want very much to not be looked at. And by anybody, certainly by those that are, you know, the abuser, but certainly not by anybody else because you don't want them to know.
Yeah.
So you hide yourself, you know. And I will say this, you know, you talk about being very thin when you were little. I wasn't heavy, but I developed early.
Yeah.
And so by third grade, I'm wearing a bra, which doesn't fly. And when other people find that out in school, there's a lot of ridicule that goes on about that. So you're very self-conscious about all of that. So anyway, long answer to your question. So.
Yeah. No, great stuff, though. But yeah, she tells a story of a woman who was sexually molested. And as she got older, she put two and two together that if she was fatter, she'd be less desirable. So she ate on purpose to gain weight so that men wouldn't find her desirable because she didn't want her body touched because it had not been touched in a manner that was loving. And I got to tell you, just reading the stories in this book, I mean, to think about how humans can treat other humans and how we shame each other is just, it's just sometimes it's hard to believe and fathom that we're doing this to one another. But at the same time, we're like, yep, we do that. I do that. You do that. Everybody does that. We just don't, we call it something differently. And we do it in a way to justify the labeling and the separateness. And we forget that when we do that to other people, these internal messages are then attached to our identity. And I thought about that, like, so with my daughter growing up, she was heavier. She was a big baby. She was almost 10 pounds and she was always off the charts. And
wow.
I just, what I had, had it not been pointed out to me, I would have never looked at her differently. But my mother, and other family members were very quick to say, you're going to have a fat kid. And aww. I just thought, wow, what kind of a label to affix to my daughter already when she's still developing and growing. But it stuck with me. And because I had been bullied about my weight and because society tells us that larger women, especially very short, large women, are just not desirable. And as a single mother, that was a great fear for me that I'd end up single because I had these two kids and I was overweight. And now I have to worry about this potentiality that I have a fat kid and what kind of these masks that we carry on with us and how it actually makes us want to not be a part of anybody else's lives. Because again, apologizing for your bodies,
right?
Instead of me apologizing, I'd just rather not interact. And
yeah, it's just easier.
Yeah. And it's, and you know, she asks another unapologetic inquiry. And in what ways have other people been affected by your body shame? And what I did is I projected my body shame onto my daughter. And my daughter, God bless her, so resilient and so just go with the flow that she was just kind of like, I'm happy with me. I mean, there were stages
for her
that I was like, okay, let's do sports. And why don't you start liking walking or running? You know, it was little subtle ways. And she'd just kind of look at me like, I know what you're trying to do and I'm happy with myself. Why can't you be? But that's because I wasn't happy with my body. I had three more children within 18 or 15 months of each other. And I was struggling still. I was still hating my body. And my husband was, you know, every day telling me I'm beautiful. I love everything about you. But I was like, but how can you? You know, I have these stretch marks and I've been called fat all my life and told blah, 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 blah. And you take that with you. Yeah. And for a long time, I started reading this book in the beginning and I was like, huh, I don't really think I've ever felt shame about my body. And it's like these unapologetic inquiries. And I was like, hold on. And then I just kind of like relived everything. But, you know, and I thought, gosh, how many of us have that mentality? Oh, I don't have body shame. I don't have body image issues. No. But all it takes is just a little trigger to make you go, holy crap, yes, I do actually. And I really need to handle this.
Yeah. I was talking with somebody yesterday. I'm not going to say who because they haven't given me, I wouldn't want to speak out of turn about somebody, but I had a conversation with somebody yesterday who deals with body conscious issues, severe, to the point where they are part of, you know, a 12-step program, whatnot. And, you know, the message is out there because I live my life this way, to count your calories, to look at your macros, the measurements, the pictures, all of these things.
Oh, yeah.
And she avoids that because those are triggers for her.
Yeah.
And she was telling me, she said, I had a wedding to go to and I was purchasing a dress online. And she said, so I decided, well, I have to get the right size. So I did my measurements. She said, the second I did my measurements, I was immediately super aware of my body. And the fact that I didn't like what I was seeing. And she said, I've been spinning for days now. And she had to call for help. She had to, you know, because it's not like drugs or alcohol where you can just say, oh, I'm not going to do those things and separate yourself from them. We all have to eat. We all have to see our bodies every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her, it became, that was a very triggering event where most of us would go right past that, not think about it. And ironically, people with the most amount of body dysmorphia, which is what we're dealing with, mm-hmm. are people that look amazing. There's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah.
You know, even by society standards. And yet there's that self-perception of something being wrong.
Yeah.
It's devastating.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally is. We take that on as our identity. And then, and she talks about how we mistakenly recognize our intersectionality as our identity. And that's going back right. to what thinking that what we believe is what we are, and thinking that what right. our body looks like is what we are. And what we love our labels. We love to stand out. We love yeah. to be set apart. But what happens is that instead of embracing the difference and the ways we are set apart, we use it as a way to say that must mean so this group is better than, or right. this group is less than, because we need our labels and we need yeah. to feel relevant. We need that status. And then where that turns into is, well, we're refusing to approach the idea that if we acknowledge difference, that might take us into having to acknowledge other things that we don't want to, such as mm-hmm. racism, sexism, homophobia. And right. so when we notice that other people are different, naturally a lot of us, because of reinforced messages, think different is dangerous or undesirable. Different must be bad. If you're not like the rest of us, there must be something wrong with you. And right. what we end up doing is we conceptualize these images of what different is, why it's bad, and what it looks like. And then she goes on to point out that a lot of us put in these images of what different is. It's people of color. It's people that are overweight. It's maybe someone who looks queer to us, who looks not like the rest of us. That must automatically be relegated to something. And so, yeah, that's that dangerous line we toe. Do I recognize difference? How do I recognize it? But if I recognize it, then what do I also have to recognize? And right. we get down to this point where we kind of sit on this line of, well, we don't need to recognize difference. And she goes on to talk about like this colorblind mentality that a lot of us have. And starting with just how we respond to people that are different, like in passing. And she references this story about a little girl who notices, or no, she doesn't even tell you it's a little girl. I just put that image there. a child who sees an individual in a wheelchair and then turns to her parent and says, why is that person in a wheelchair? And so while you're reading this, you're already developing. And so I developed an idea and an image, a little child mm-hmm. and a mother at a grocery store, and probably a larger woman sitting in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And just the thought that I put a female in all of those positions signifies oh, something that society has influenced us to think.
Sure.
And so when the parent responds to the child, it's in this fashion of not making eye contact with the person that she asked the question about, or the child asked the question about. It's more so, I'm embarrassed that you even pointed this out. Let's go. Well, now you've right. just reinforced into that child's mind that difference must be bad and you must mm-hmm. feel ashamed about it. And there we go with the perpetuation.
Right.
So one of the things that she points out then is that when we take this colorblind approach, and when we say, I don't see difference and I don't see color and we're all the same and we're all one race, we're erasing the intersections of the individuality of people. And we should be allowed to, and we should find it acceptable to praise the difference in others. And I look at Absolutely. It like this, yeah. you know, if God is all in all, then we are all unique, distinct reflections of God. And there is no way that God is homogenous and right. so easy to just paint and depict. So we have to consider the possibility that each individual person is just reflecting another piece of the wholeness of God.
Right.
And embracing and acknowledging and appreciating difference and not thinking that it's undesirable or dangerous. And that means not saying things like, I don't see you as a Black woman. Please do. Please recognize her beautiful Blackness, because for Absolutely. So long she was told that her Blackness was bad. You know, and my friend is a Black woman, and she has been in that situation where people have said that to her, and she's like, why do you want to pretend that I am not who I am and that I do not look like what I look like? Please see me because I see you. And going even further back, biologically, we're programmed to. I mean, that's how we know how to distinct and how to survive. We have to be able to recognize a difference, but we don't need to always assume that difference is bad. And so, yeah, I just really appreciated that part about it. And it really resonated with me specifically, because just in my own personal life with a friend who is going through this erasure, basically, of who she is, right. it's just like, wow, it's still happening and it's right here in front of me. And I just appreciate when people take a moment to just point that out, how that does, in fact, lead to body shame, especially Black and brown body shame.
Right.
And we just need to be more aware of that.
Now, I think celebrating difference is something that needs to be taught more, and not hiding. Like, you know, the example you gave of the wheelchair. I mean, I can remember standing in a grocery line with one of my kids. I don't remember which one. Oh, the man in front of us who had an amputated arm, and I was incredibly uncomfortable because whichever child it was, ask about it. I was uncomfortable, but that was me projecting my sense of being uncomfortable onto this man, because he seemed more than happy to explain, and he wasn't uncomfortable at all. And my child had their question answered, and that was that. I stood there feeling like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, but they were fine. Yeah. So, yeah. I just think it's learning a different response.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we just don't do that very well, or, you know, we don't want to make anybody else, even at our best intention, we just don't want to make somebody else uncomfortable. So we avoid.
Yeah.
When the answer is to confront and say, let's celebrate that. Let's look at the differences. Let's look at the skin color and say, you know, there's beauty. There's absolute beauty in that. So why would we ignore it?
Yes.
Or say that it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yep. Good points. Yeah. I agree. My children do that all the time, you know, and children are so present, you know, they're just right there in the moment. They notice something, they're aware, and they're like, now I have questions, you know, and if it's a new experience, we should encourage that. And, you know, most people, I'm sure there's a cranky old fart once in a while, but most people realize that children are just inquisitive, and you must not have never seen anybody like me before. I get that.
Right.
You know, most people are not looking at you like, what did you have your kid ask me that question for? What is going, you know, because no. So yeah. Grace, just extend a little grace for your kids. Don't project like, oh yeah. Well, you know, ask them, you know, when my children see people in wheelchairs, they're like, look at how cool that is. They're, you know, and I'm like, right. Isn't that cool? Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, they're different and they have these cool wheels on top of it. So they must be extraordinary people. And what's wrong with encouraging that idea instead of looking at other people as dangerous or undesirable? So, yeah.
Right.
And what that difference does, you know, I think when you start categorizing difference as bad, you're really just unplugging and trying to disconnect. And
yeah.
And so I would say aim towards connecting. If something is different and you don't understand it, connect with something or someone and try and understand it. And then realize that different isn't scary. It's just different. Right. And so then another thing that she talks about is this idea of body terrorism. And body terrorism is our beliefs about our body image based on like societal influences. And I really like this concept. And she, you know, she talks about this radical reflection of our beliefs about bodies disproportionately impact those whose race, gender, sexual orientation, ability, and age deviate from our default notions. The further from default, the greater the impact. We are all affected, but not equally. And we don't realize that this, the very obvious and blatant messages, along with the subliminal messages that we're inundated with every single day, only perpetuates this body terrorism in which we accept the defaults of what a person is supposed to look like. And then we fuel it with consumerism in trying to reach at fixing our body flaws by buying things to be normal and making purchases to make us feel better. You know, we're inundated with all these images and messages every day. And so then we start thinking, I must need something in order to aspire to this perfect image, and let me go after it. And so she asks you, you know, when was the last time you made a purchase because you didn't feel good? And did that purchase change how you felt? And if so, for how long? And I was like sitting there like, shoot, I do that all the time.
Yeah.
I do retail therapy. Like when I'm feeling down, I'm like, I'm just going to buy something. And it's horrible because then I do it too. And I'm like, well, there was this woman who was wearing, like, I just felt like I was so underdressed for this thing that I went to. And, you know, what am I doing? And what kind of reputation am I creating for myself? I just look sloppy. And so now I have to keep up with those. Like their shoes were amazing. Right. And oh my God, I'm sitting here in my, oh, your steel-toed boots, Danielle. That's pretty cool. And, you know, and I shame myself.
Steel-toed boots.
I know. I like have three pairs of steel-toed shoes and boots. So there you go. But I have cows too. And you don't want them stepping on
you. You do have cows. Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, I was like, yeah, I think a lot of us do that. Like, and then you think, like, how many women are in the malls right now? Or we're not in malls anymore. How many women are on Amazon right now going, oh, I feel like crap. Maybe I should get a new bedspread. Maybe if I had a pretty bedspread, I'd feel better when I went to bed at night, and then I'd wake up in a better mood. Or maybe that's just what I did last week. So I don't know.
Just recently. I don't know. I used to have a coping mechanism. I would mess with my hair. I would cut it, or I would color it, or I would do something horrible to it. And I would always end up hating it, which then would just justify how stupid I was. And honestly, I mean, the self-talk was really, really bad. And so I broke that by not allowing myself to do my own hair anymore. And it's much more expensive, obviously.
Yeah.
But I kind of broke that outlet for self-hatred. And of course, then I started working on me, so I didn't have the self-hatred, but for a long time, I was even aware that I was doing it, and it was still my defense mechanism. It was still how I handled it. So we do a lot of weird things to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
All in the name of trying to be better, or what we perceive to be better.
Yeah. Yeah. And that just contributes to this idea of this body terrorism. And she points out in one of her unapologetic inquiries that destroying the system of body terrorism requires an investigation into our unconscious beliefs about other bodies. Remember, we are not our beliefs. We can examine them without judgment and shame. From a place of curiosity and compassion, explore the social, cultural, and political messages you have received about bodies listed below. How have those messages informed your relationship with those bodies? And so here are the bodies referenced: fat bodies, bodies of other races, lesbian or gay bodies, transgender bodies, disabled bodies, aging bodies, and bodies with mental illness. And it, you know, for me, I just see these descriptions, and I think, you know, every day on social media, I can see somebody shaming one form of these bodies. And I bet you if I really thought about it and was really honest, I've done the same. And we don't realize that is a terrorism towards humanity when we are, again, going back to that whole difference is dangerous. And so, you know, her suggestion is for us to be more aware of how much body shame and body terrorism content that we're absorbing. And sometimes we do need to kind of sort through the static and question, what am I watching and why, and what is it contributing to, and what am I being influenced by, and how is that making me feel internally, and what am I doing to project that outward? And so I just thought that was a great piece of advice. And, you know, I started doing that. I was like, I noticed myself today this whole Alabama bill with the with abortion, it had me so angry. And I was just reacting. And then I thought, you know what? We're just shaming each other right now. We're just reacting. And so I, you know, and it was like, you're getting these negative ideas of women's bodies, and looking at women's bodies as just merely objective containers that can be controlled. And so sometimes we do just have to step back, and we can acknowledge that there is clearly oppression within our society, but perpetuating the shame and the terrorism on other people is not the way that we're going to resolve it. And right. In fact, we need to connect, not disconnect, in order to resolve it. So, and then speaking of connecting, the next topic that really, that I appreciated greatly because of things that I, because of a book I'm working on, I should say, is pleasure of the body and why it's important and why we should explore our terrain. And so I just want to read a little bit of this section. First, she says, it is impossible to be a responsible steward of a body we constantly avoid being intimate with. If exploration is like a map quest of our bodies, it tells us the basics. Then examination is the app with real-time traffic updates. Understanding our unique terrain gives us access to awareness. With awareness, we can be alerted when something is off kilter. Noticing skin discoloration or variations in body mass gives us the information we need to advocate for our own well-being. Doctors are fantastic, but they do not know your body better than you. Examination makes you an expert in you, and you should be. Lastly, touch yourself for ecstasy. Our bodies are designed for pleasure, but so many of us deny ourselves the riches of our own sensual touch. A 2009 Psychology Today article reported on a comprehensive analysis of 33 studies of female orgasm over the preceding 80 years. The analysis was conducted by Elizabeth Lloyd, author of The Case of the Female Orgasm. She found that only about half of women sometimes have orgasms during intercourse, and about 20% seldom or never have orgasms during intercourse, and about 5% never have orgasms, period. Physiology is a key reason for the lack of female orgasm. Most orgasms are achieved through clitoral stimulation, and there is generally not enough friction during intercourse to generate arousal to orgasm. Know what might help such an issue? Touching yourself. When we touch ourselves sexually,
common sense.
I know, we are not just getting ourselves off, which is wonderful, but we are becoming masterful tour guides for our lovers. We know all the most breathtaking views and the best places to dine. Giving ourselves pleasure is a powerful way to teach others how to please us. Radical self-love is built on the foundation of intimacy with our bodies. Get intimate with your body, and it will teach you and others how to love it. And I just love that. And look. Yeah. My husband was in Iraq for a year, so I understand.
Became familiar.
Why exploring your terrain is important.
Exploring your terrain. But, oh my God.
You know what? My mom taught me when my mom caught me when I was little.
Oh, how wonderful.
And she did not make me feel bad about it. She said,
"Oh, good.
That's good. You should touch yourself. I would prefer that you don't do it while your door is wide open."
Yeah, exactly. And,
yeah, just do it. And, you know, do it in private. That's good. You know, so I was encouraged. And I always asked, you know, crazy questions growing up. But yeah, a lot of women are afraid to touch their bodies. And when we're afraid to touch our bodies, that can lead to medical problems if we're not aware of what's going on.
Sure.
With our bodies. And so that alone for me is like, I think I was like 9 when I first heard about the breast exam, and I didn't have boobs for another 5 years, I still tried. You know, make sure there's no lump, the wrong, we don't want the wrong lumps there.
Right,
I would have gone for any kind of bumps at that time, but I had to wait. But you know, ecstasy is not a naughty word, and that's a part of her unapologetic inquiry. And so because our bodies are designed for pleasure, she wants you to sit back and ask yourself, you know, in which ways have you thought about what would pleasure your body? And now pick two of them and go try them. Mm-hmm. So there's the advice for wrapping up this book. Go get yourself off, girl, you know? But no, I just want to leave. I just want to end this with actually four mantras that she suggests within the book. And I'm all about daily affirmations. My previous life coach, Jamal, helped me kind of create this habit of giving myself daily affirmations and just kind of reminding myself who I am. And so she does this as well. And the four that she recommends that I just really liked were these. I love my body. I am a vessel of radical self-love. My body is my ally. I have the body I need to live my best life. And so I love this book. I recommend any woman read this book, any man read this book, because it's not just for women, it's for men too. And she does deliver a lot of content from the male perspective, also from the queer perspective. So it's a treasure of a book. And I really appreciated it. We need more voices like this to just come out and help us remind us that it's okay to love ourselves. And that's ultimately, I think, what Jesus was teaching us too, to love ourselves. So great book. I loved it. And now I'm so ready to hear about your book, Michelle.
Well, we're just going to continue on the subject of love. I mean, so my book was All About Love by Bell Hooks. I came across Bell Hooks by listening to Brené Brown, who speaks very highly of Bell Hooks. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of her, so I had to go and look. And I think I mentioned to you before when I announced I was doing this book, she's got so many, and all of them sound so amazing.
Yeah.
And she writes so conversationally. You feel like you're in the middle of a conversation with her on the subject matter. So I really just appreciated that about her book. I'm going to tell you, there was so much in this book, I'm not going to get to all of it. So I tried to pick the ones that I could just kind of highlight and make sure that I give as much to those as I can. Unfortunately, since I won't be able to hit all of them, you guys will have to go get the book and read it.
Yeah.
It's not a hard read at all. But she separates her book on love into different sections. And so I'm going to start with clarity. Mm-hmm. Because she sets the stage by saying, you know, how do we want to define love? And I think for most of us, it's very subjective.
Yeah.
We all look at love and we identify with it in different ways. And so one of the first quotes that I have here from her is, everyone admits that love is wonderful and necessary, yet no one can agree on what it is. We use the word love in such a sloppy way that it can mean almost nothing or absolutely everything. And you think about that, how we have, I don't know a good way to say it. We've kind of bastardized the word itself.
Yeah.
It's become a marketing tool. We love everything from pizza to horses. And if I say I love pizza, what does that mean about my children? I mean, you know, so we've kind of just, we've taken the word and kind of lessened its impact, because we've applied it to so many things. And so I think that's why it is so subjective and why people have such a hard time with it. She actually has a definition that she really likes, and this is the words that she used: the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth.
Wow, that's beautiful.
So, now that has nothing to do with pizza.
No.
It kind of brings it more back into line with what typically love should be. Love is an act of the will, you know, or it's an intention, it's an action. I don't know if you've ever heard of Heidi Baker.
I have not.
She's a missionary. She's a pretty well-known missionary in the evangelical world. But I actually love her heart. And one of the things that she says all the time is love actually looks like something. And so what she means is it's an action. It's something I'm doing that others can identify that's love.
Yeah.
You know, and so I tend to lean towards that kind of definition myself, because I feel like it really encompasses. I'll be honest, the first chapter kind of shocked me.
Why
I didn't think
that?
We were gonna. Well, I didn't think we were gonna talk about abuse. I guess it's a book about love. We're not gonna talk about abuse.
Yeah.
But after reading it, I sat there and read like a good portion of the first chapter to my husband one night. I'm like, listen to this. listen to this. Yeah. And he was like, oh my God, it's like she knows our history, you know, as children and all these things, because she was talking about love and abuse cannot exist.
Yeah.
Love absolutely cannot exist in an abusive relationship. And I know a lot of people would probably push back at that and say, well, you know, I think people that abuse others, they still do love them. But really? I mean,
yeah.
I think back about the things that I lived with when I was younger and the people that I assumed loved me. And I think it really warped me. When the people that say they love you are abusing you, it changes your view on love. There's no way it can't. Mm-hmm. And it conditions you to continue to live your life from a place of accepting abuse in the name of love.
Yeah.
Because, well, that's how it looks like. That's what it looks like. That's how it works.
Yeah. And I always think too, I remember reading something where even when it comes down to even verbal abuse and, you know, being mm-hmm. violent with our words, in that moment, when we're doing that action, there's no love.
Exactly.
And I come to a point, you know, where me and my husband have gotten into fights and we say things we don't really want to or mean probably, but then we have to stop and go, you know what? I can't be loving to you right now because I'm feeling all these other feelings that are not love. And right. I always kind of think that I don't know if so much love is constant, but it is in fact an act and it's demonstrated and maybe only recognized thereafter, kind of like kenosis.
Maybe.
Love can only exist when the ego is not in control and all over the place. And
well, yeah, because you definitely have to give up the ego.
Yeah. And so,
to love another person.
I love that idea that, love looks like something.
Right. Absolutely. And that has always stuck with me. I've heard that years ago and that has always kind of stuck with me. Going back to the idea of abuse, she wrote this and I so identified with this. She said, an overwhelming majority of us come from dysfunctional families in which we were taught we were not okay. We were shamed, verbally or physically abused, and emotionally neglected, even as we were also taught to believe that we were loved. Mm. Now, I was raised by a grandmother who was a very stern, not a very nice lady.
Yeah.
But she constantly told me she loved me. The same woman, however, was a very harsh disciplinarian, and I would have to listen for quite a while before she actually, in her words, disciplined me, the fact that she had to do this because she loved me. Ugh. So basically, before I beat the hell out of you, I'm going to tell you that I have to do this because I love you. Well, you have just guaranteed to screw somebody up for life.
Yeah.
If that's the viewpoint that you have. Now, I'm old enough now and in looking at it from a psychological perspective to say she was a warped person herself.
Mm-hmm.
She came from an abusive background herself. So she was what she learned.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
And you just passed down that genetic trauma.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you do. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the biggest challenges of my life was to not repeat that.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I failed and sometimes, and I think the majority of the time I did not fail. And I'm hopeful that my children would agree with me.
Well, I think I failed in some points when you say that thing,
we all like, do.
Well, how she would say all this stuff and then, but I love you. I think back to my kids, you know, I'd lecture or berate.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you know, I love you. And their response would always be, do you? And I always think, what do you mean? Do I? Of course. Well, that didn't feel like it. And for so long, I was like, what are you talking about? Well, love is tough. And, you know, but then years passed and I was like, they were right. Like, was that loving? Like you say all that stuff and make it all about you, you know, because most of us as parents, it's all about how you made me feel. It's not really about how you feel. And then I love you. Like, I just said all this stuff. I love you. I just shot you in the chest. I love you. What? No, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did it because I love you. Well, that's bipolar love right there.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely warped. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I think, though, that like I said, looking at it as an adult, and I'm not making any justifications or excuses from people, but I think that there is a place where they believe that they are acting in love.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, as we said, that passes that mindset on. And so we're all conditioned into that idea, almost to the point when somebody pushes back against that and says, well, you can't love somebody if you do that to them. We defend it.
Yeah.
We defend actually abusing somebody.
Yeah.
because we've been conditioned to believe that that equates to love.
Yeah.
Which is very sad. I mean, horribly sad. But she goes on, she talks about, the next bit she talks about is justice. Justice or childhood love lessons. And she actually did some study in on this, and she found that, as it pertained to discipline, there was kind of a difference in the way men and women approached discipline.
Yeah.
She said men spoke loudest in defense of physical punishment. Women, or mostly mothers, talked about hitting as a last resort, but one that they deployed when it was necessary. Hmm. And I think I was probably there as a younger mother. I you know, I didn't like discipline, but I felt like it was my obligation to discipline my children and to in order to make sure that they grew up to be good, productive human beings and adults. I will say this: I couldn't do the physical punishment after a certain period of time. I felt it was too awful. And my husband came from kind of the same background. And so we kind of went to more of an idea of like push-ups or run a lap for discipline or something.
My husband did the push-up thing.
I used to make my boys do push-ups facing each other when they fought. I'd make them get down on the ground and do push-ups looking at each other, and they had to count them off together. And if one of them messed up, they had to start all over again.
Yeah.
And more often than not, that they'd sit there and start laughing with one another. And it would be over. And, you know, even that, though, I mean, I look back at it and I think they kind of look at that and laugh about it now, too. But there was still this idea behind it, like, I have to make these people act correctly.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you show up. That's how I show I love them.
Yeah.
And that's still somewhat warped. I'm not saying we shouldn't raise our children, have some form of discipline or something, but we should certainly be doing it not from a place of coercing them into being who we want them to be.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of times that's what it turns into.
Yeah.
Then she starts talking about social myths, and she's like, one of the most important social myths we must debunk if we are to become a more loving culture is the one that teaches parents that abuse and neglect can coexist with love. Mm. One of the myths about lovelessness is that it exists only among the poor and the deprived. Yet lovelessness is not a function of poverty or material lack. In homes where material privileges abound, children often suffer emotional neglect and abuse.
Oh, wow.
So we can't look at this lack of love or this confusion about love as though it's some kind of a class system problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a societal, it's a cultural problem.
Universal, probably.
Absolutely. Universal human problem.
Yeah.
And so we have to kind of look at it that way and say, well, we have to have a sense of justice,
mm-hmm.
Because without justice, there can't be love. But mm-hmm. at the same time, we want that justice to be performed in love, not, you know, as a way to distort love.
Yeah. And in a way to, I would say that in comparison to God's justice, it has to look like love. It has to transform, I would think.
You know, I've heard this before, and I actually had somebody say it yesterday in a conversation, that justice is not necessarily negative, but yet we've been conditioned to believe that justice means something negative.
Yeah.
As certainly as it pertains to God.
Yeah.
Well, God is just. Well, does that mean he's an ass? Or does that mean that his love produces justice? I mean, I think that's what we have to, you know, well, there he's a judge. Okay, but isn't the judgment sometimes not guilty?
Yeah.
Debt, you know, gotten rid of or whatever. I mean, why do we only see it from that negative side and decide that justice and love don't go together because of that? I think there's a connection there. Like, because we have this negative viewpoint of justice, we can't associate it with love, and they have to go together.
That disconnect.
If we truly love somebody.
Yeah. And that disconnect of being able to separate the two as you can have this over here. You know, I remember the constant argument being, well, yeah, God is love, but God is also just. And those mean different things. Well, no, they shouldn't, because that means that God's kind of a hypocrite.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, that's the comment, you know, oh, God is love, but he's also just. We always have a caveat.
Yeah.
God being love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a disappointment, because I think we really have diminished God.
Yeah.
And certainly how God treats people because of that. And then by extension, how we treat one another.
Yeah.
That's upsetting, I think. Anyway, so she goes on to talk about love as honesty, being true to love. And she kind of brings in some gender roles here. From the moment little boys are taught they should not cry or express hurt, feelings of loneliness or pain, that they must be tough, they are learning how to mask their true feelings. So as society, we have created these gender roles, specifically as it pertains to boys and men, that say, well, you have to act a certain way or you're not really a man. And there's often times when men express love where it can be construed as weakness or being soft, or as though these are bad things. And so it's kind of funny. I don't know if you've ever watched the show Friends.
Okay.
So there's an episode. I always have something playing when I'm working. Just helps distract my brain, because I tend to do too many things at once, and it helps me compartmentalize. But I had it playing in the background, and there's an episode in the later seasons where Jennifer Aniston is dating Bruce Willis, and he's this big tough guy, you know. And so she wants to get to know him better, and she's like, "I just share a little bit of you with me, just, you know, a little bit of emotion. I just want to know who you are." You know? And so of course he does. And then when he does, he like falls apart. He's just this big blob of emotion. And all of a sudden you can see it change. He's like, well, I didn't want that.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's kind of what she's talking about here. Like, you know, we've kind of pigeonholed men into being able to respond to love or anything that we perceive to be about love in a very pigeonholed way. We've left them in this little box and said, you're only allowed to show this much emotion. Or we're going to have a very different viewpoint of you. So we've created this place or this space where men don't feel comfortable to express love. And yet we're not satisfied because they're not expressing love. So it's a big conundrum, but it made me laugh. Yeah. I read this book and that scene came to mind, and I thought, we often end up not wanting what we've asked for, but we're hurting ourselves.
Yeah. That's how it was when I met my husband. He was like, the first night we met, and he was crying in front of me, and I was going, this is weird. This is so not what I expected. Like, honestly, I expected it to be like, oh, I met him. It was honestly like one night stand maybe, and then I'll never see you again. But he cried, and I was like, wow. And then I thought about it, and then he wanted to see me the next day, and I was like, you know,
I don't know.
That was different, but I'd never had that before.
Yeah.
You know, the other men I had dated, it was like, why are you so emotional? Why do you cry all the time to me? Yeah. And I'm like, why don't you?
Right.
And then it felt like the roles reversed with me and my husband. I started going, you're the emotional one, sweetie. Like, you cry all the time. Like, and he's always like, are you going to cry? Like, just go cry. You know, you need to cry. And I'm like, I'm not going to cry. You know, and we switched roles. But I appreciated that about him because and then it made me want to create more of those little things. So that's how I am with my sons. You can cry. It's okay to cry.
Yeah.
My older son likes to kind of pick on the younger boys. Why are you crying when they wrestle? Aww. And I'm like, let him cry. Yeah. It's okay to cry. Don't make him feel bad about crying.
Yeah, don't demonize that.
No, let it. It's beautiful.
What happens is we have men grow up to be only able to show, you know, very few emotions. And one of those main emotions then becomes anger.
Yeah.
Because that's comfortable. That's it's culturally acceptable for a man to express anger rather than sadness.
Yeah.
Or what we perceive to be sappy love.
Yeah.
You know. And let's think about it. And maybe we've talked about this before. I don't remember. But the idea that women are often very culpable in the discussion on patriarchy.
Yeah.
Because of the considerations that we put on the men in our lives, the expectations. Yeah. You know. We all have this idea of the man on the white horse, this romantic hero, but he's a tough guy. He's an alpha male. He's commanding. Yeah. He's in charge. You know, there's that, there's an attraction to that. Yeah. And so as soon as a man shows softness, you know, or something that we perceive as weakness or feminine, we immediately question him. So he has to become that person that we're expecting him to be. Well, that's playing into the patriarchal role.
Oh, yeah,
so
I agree.
Responsible for that, too.
Yeah, women are, I would say, at least 50%. I think we're equal in participating and perpetuating the patriarchy. We just, it's hard for women to accept it because we're like, I'm a woman, I can't. Right. Well, yeah, you can, though. And if you step back and think, I know I have. Yeah, I was like, here's my ticket to the patriarchy. Let me play. Mm-hmm. But then you step back and you're like, oh, yeah, I did do that. Yeah, yeah, we are. Absolutely. You're right. We are culpable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I want my husband to look the way that I want him to look, but that has mm-hmm. to be, you know. So basically they're trying to figure out, well, where do I fit in here? Like, so am I supposed to be warm and sappy and lovey right now, or am I supposed mm-hmm. to be alpha male fix it all? You know, which one do you want? And unfortunately, they're playing a role too. So again, love does not dictate that somebody acquiesce to our demands.
That's right.
And that's out of the Bible. Love does not demand its own way. Mm-mm. So we do this to one another, and unfortunately we are contributing to a lot of these roles in domination society that we, on one hand, are saying we're unhappy with, but yet on the other hand, we're either expecting it or we're actively supporting it.
Yeah.
So it's something to consider, at least for those of you that are going to get mad, that's something to at least consider. She ends this chapter with this quote: "The wounded child inside many males is a boy who, when he first spoke his truths, was silenced by paternal sadism, by a patriarchal world that did not want him to claim his true feelings. Mm-hmm. The wounded child inside many females is a girl who was taught from early childhood on that she must become something other than herself, deny her true feelings, in order to attract and please others." I can't think of a more true statement for either one of those genders. Yeah. I mean, it's just, those are the cultural expectations.
Yeah.
And they really disconnect us from being able to truly love one another.
Yeah.
For who we are. And that doesn't even go into the whole topic of the spectrum of gender
mm-hmm.
identity. I mean, you know, we've put all of these gender roles into certain places, and if you act outside of those, then your actual sexuality is questioned.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's so much more to all of these things. I'm going to go on to the next one because we could talk about that for a long time. And I know I'm running out of time. So she talks about commitment. Let love be love in me. And I think this goes back to kind of some of the stuff you were talking about with your book, the idea of self-love.
Mm-hmm.
And so she asks the questions, you know, like where does worthlessness come from? And she says, look, that's an important question, but it's not the only question. We shouldn't get stuck there. That's stage one. Where does our worthlessness come from? But if we just stay there, all we do is perpetuate a cycle of continuing to see ourselves as worthless. So mm-hmm. she actually does talk about doing some of that work for yourself. And you mentioned affirmations a little bit ago. I have those as well, affirmations or intentions or whatever we mm-hmm. want to call them. But those statements that are strong I am statements that say that are bettering ourselves, that is a way of loving ourselves. Yeah. And beginning to change how we see ourselves so that we're able to better love ourselves. And so there was a quote here she had. First of all, she's very adamant that self-love is not selfish. And I think that needs to be reiterated over and over and over.
Yeah.
Because often we feel guilty if we take care of ourselves.
Yeah.
It's an old example, but I think it's a pertinent one. When you're on a plane, they tell you if the oxygen masks come down, you don't put yours on, you put yours on first so that you can then help somebody else. Well, that's applicable to everything in life. If you can't take care of yourself, you're never going to take care of somebody else. And as mothers, certainly we understand that the demands on our time to take care of house and children and family are so big that mm-hmm. often we forget to take care of ourselves. And next thing you know, we're anxious, we're stressed out, we're having health issues, we're exhausted,
mm-hmm.
Depressed, you know, any number of things that are going on in our bodies because we haven't taken care of ourselves. So she actually said,
I'm totally on. I do that. I notice I do that. Like that whole sleep. Who the heck needs sleep? Yeah. And my husband's like, you need sleep.
Absolutely.
And so I've been more intentional in the last few, I'd say the last week or so. Well, last night I wasn't. I was up till 5. That was bad. But
oh my god,
I was writing. I was writing,
but still,
I didn't do that at all previously this week. So I get it. Because if I can't, if I can't function, I am not going to be functional for anybody else.
Right.
Yeah.
But she goes on and she talks about the idea that, you know, I thought this was a really weird example, but at the same time, it makes some sense to me. She she goes back and talks about when President Clinton was in office. And she likens this idea to us, you know, we're trying to portray this certain personality or persona to everybody around us. But deep inside, if we haven't done the work of self-love, we don't believe the story we're telling.
Yeah.
And it's always going to come out. And so she, I'm going to just read this. I think it's a good example of that. She said, President Clinton engaged in deceitful behavior, betraying both his personal commitments to his family as well as political commitments to be a paragon of American values to the people of this country. He did so when his popularity was at an all-time high. Having spent much of his life achieving against the odds, his actions expose a fundamental flaw in his self-esteem. Although he is a white male, Ivy League educated and economically well-off, privileged with all of the accompanying perks, his irresponsible actions were a way of unmasking, of showing to the world that he really was not the good guy he was pretending to be. Now, that's some deep psychological stuff there.
Yeah, it is.
So basically, you have every advantage in the world. You have achieved the highest office in the world. Mm-hmm. And you do something that is so stupid by political standards.
Yeah.
And so what she's basically saying is he subconsciously sabotaged because he didn't really believe all of those things about himself.
Wow. Or
maybe I'm reading into it, but that's what it seems to say to me.
Yeah.
And so she's like, if we succeed without confronting and changing our shaky foundations of low self-esteem rooted in contempt and hatred, we're going to falter. So self-love is absolutely essential.
Yeah.
And that means that sometimes, as I said, self-love is not selfish, but sometimes it can appear that way because sometimes it means we have to set everything else aside, say, look, I got to take care of me right now.
Setting boundaries. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm horrible at that. I'm getting much better at it.
I feel the same way. I'm
working on it. So
yeah, I totally relate to that. The setting boundaries for me, I always feel like I'm being mean.
Yeah, like, exactly.
If I say, look, I just need some me time. Or okay, so the last 3 weeks in my life were me running all over the place and helping other people, which I wanted to do. And like and last week wasn't even planned. My daughter went into labor 14 weeks early and had a baby.
So and congratulations, Grandma.
Thank you. Yeah, Grandma. Weird. But it was after I knew everything was kind of calm that I went, I got to decompress. I can't go anywhere. I don't want to see people. I really don't even want to talk to anyone. And it was over Mother's Day weekend. And I was like, I love you, Lily. Happy Mother's Day. But like, I got to do this. And exactly. I told that to everyone. And I'm like, I just need to decompress. And some people were understanding and other people are like, well, I need to talk to you. And I'm like, look. I get it, but I need to focus on me right now because I haven't slept. I haven't been eating. It's been crazy. And yeah, I always worry I'm going to look mean or I'm going to hurt someone's feelings or what if they really need me, but I really need sleep and what do I do? But we have to set those boundaries. It's important.
We do. And they are difficult because we do have so many demands on our time and so many people do count on us for different things. But again, back to that example, I can help no one if I cannot. If I'm not here, you know, so it kind of has to come back to that side of things. Speaking from a spirituality, she's talking about divine love here, and I'm gonna end with this one even, and I'll list the rest of them afterwards. But she's talking about that kind of love that comes out of spirituality. Mm. You know, what we would think of as the love of God, or you know, and the love that's produced in us through a relationship with God or a higher power. But she's saying, look, there's not much evidence of that in our society right now. Mm-hmm. She said our national spiritual hunger springs from a keen awareness of the emotional lack in our lives. Mm-hmm. It is a response to lovelessness. Going to church or temple has not satisfied this hunger surfacing from deep within our souls. Organized religion has failed to satisfy spiritual hunger because it has accommodated secular demands, interpreting spiritual life in a way that upholds the values of a production-centered commodity culture.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a statement.
Yep.
That's a statement.
That's a good one.
Because I can look around and I see so many, because I'm a Christian, I've grew up in the Christian church, I will identify there and say, I have seen so much of what we call church now being nothing more than religious corporation.
Yep.
And unfortunately, that does have an effect on the spirituality of people. And I do believe that that is also why we're seeing kind of an exodus from the traditional church structures. People are hungry for this spirituality, for this love, for this connection, and they're not getting it.
Yeah.
They're not seeing it modeled. They're not seeing concern come out of the doors of the church to the community at large. And that's disturbing. It was for me. Yeah. It really was for me. And that's where I started to struggle and to kind of stumble along in my belief structure because I didn't see it modeled the way I thought it needed to be. So she's saying, look, this is a problem. She said, religious fundamentalism is often represented as authentic spiritual practice and given a level of mass media exposure that countercultural religious thought and practice never receive. Usually, fundamentalists, be they Christian, Muslim, or any shape, faith, and interpret religious thought to make it conform to and legitimize a conservative status quo. Fundamentalist thinkers use religion to justify supporting imperialism, militarism, sexism, racism, homophobia. They deny the unifying message of love that is at the heart of every major religious tradition.
Yep, yep.
She's saying, look at what the lack of love has done to our religious tradition. It has created a fundamental monster. And I don't think a truer statement is available. I think that so much of what we see identifying itself as Christian love is nothing more than control and power.
Yeah.
On demand.
Absolutely.
It's asking people to capitulate to a popular viewpoint that may or may not even be rooted in historic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very large problem. Now that last part is just me pontificating on the subject, but that's not in her book. But she says, a commitment to spiritual life necessarily means that we embrace the eternal principle that love is all, everything, our true destiny.
I love that.
Yeah, that's a great way to wrap it up because I really feel like that's what it's supposed to be before we mess it all up.
Yeah.
And actually, I'll finish with this. She said, and she's quoting, of course, the Bible. If I speak with the tongue of men and angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. That's the importance of love.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate connection. And so, as I said, she has a few more here listed. She goes through values, greed, community, mutuality, romance, loss, healing, and destiny. So there's probably another whole podcast worth of explanation there. The book is fantastic. As I said, there's so much here. Even in what I've covered, I didn't even do it justice. So again, the book is called All About Love, Bell Hooks. Fabulous writer, great subject matter, and something so desperately needed to be dealt with in our society and within each one of us personally.
Yeah. Great choice, Michelle. Seriously.
Yeah, I loved it. I really did.
I really loved hearing all about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
So what book are you going to do next time?
Well, I'm going to pop off the last topic I talked about with the body and pleasure. So my next book will be Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life by Emily Nagoski.
Okay.
And she did a TED Talk. And that's what drew me to her. It was during my research when I was looking for some more information for the marriage book I'm working on. And yeah, I fell in love with her. She's quirky and funny and talks really super fast and uses nothing but super big words. And it's super sexy to me. So yeah, I can't get enough of her. And her book is awesome. And yeah. So what are you reading?
I am going to pull out an oldie but a goodie. It's called The Orthodox Heretic and Other Impossible Tales by Peter Rollins. Oh. If anybody knows Peter Rollins, he's an Irish philosopher. Love listening to him talk. And he's incredibly insightful, very, very smart individual. And the book is really just a collection of stories that you draw so many moral values from. And so it's very interesting. So we'll see how I'll be able to present that, but it's one of my favorites. So
I'm sure you'll do a great job. You present all your books so wonderfully.
Oh, well, so do you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So,
all right,
so
our lovely listeners.
All right, go ahead.
Oh, I didn't know if I was going to say it this time or not.
It doesn't matter. Go ahead.
Well, our lovely listeners, we want to remind you that if there's a book that's inspired you and you'd like us to consider discussing it on our next show, please email your recommendation to bookish@choir.com or find our group on Facebook and join, and you can share a recommendation there. And if we choose your book suggestion, we'll be sure to give you a shout out on our next episode. Until then, we'll see you later, listeners.